I've been reading consecutively through Srimad Bhagavatam, and just before coming here, I was in Boston, as they say in New England, Boston, and we were reading from a chapter that was pretty scary. Description of adverse fruitive activities, the living entity living a life of forgetfulness of Krishna, got himself in a pack of trouble, and ends up being introduced to the Yamadutas and the journey from this body to Yamalokas, pretty scary, and then even before they come before Yamaraj, it's pretty scary. I decided to skip ahead. Because next comes, you know, invitation to the hellish planets, and that's pretty scary. The next chapter is Kapila's instructions on the movements of the living entity. So I'm going to read the first four verses. Do a little summary. This is a very large section of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's Satya Yuga, the very beginning part of Satya Yuga. In fact, it's the very beginning part of the life of Brahma, because there's in each day of Brahma, there's so many 1,000 Satya Yugas. This is the beginning of Brahma's life, and Swayambhuva Manu is the first Manu, and his daughter Devahuti marries Kardama Muni, and many things happen. Thousands, tens of thousands of years of austerities while he, together in the forest, the beginning of Satya Yuga is like nothing. Swayambhuva Manu has a palace, and so she left the palace to go live in the forest with her, the husband of her choice. Superlatively qualified in devotion, so much so that even before they were married, Lord Vishnu came and pronounced, "Your wife is going to come in a few days," and say, "Yes, she's very qualified. I will appear as your son." So later he appeared as the son of Devahuti and Kardamoni, Lord Kapila. There's many other things, but the agreement to accept Devahuti, Swayambhuva made the marriage proposal. Lord Vishnu already said to say yes, so he said yes, but he had a condition, and the condition was when there is a son of sufficient age to look after your daughter, then I would like to be able to go to the forest and again complete my practices of devotion. So that was the commitment from Swayambhuva Manu, and when Kapila was of age to care for his mother, off he went. Kardama Muni went back to the forest to continue his practices of devotion connected with the process of meditation. So that takes about three chapters. And then chapter 25 begins with Devahuti seated before her son, who she knows is the personality of Godhead. Very interesting dialogue. She knows he's God, asking God, her son, to relieve her of undue affection or attachment for family life. And then, you know, the circumstances, the person who she has been married to for tens of thousands of years and serving lovingly and faithfully, super qualified, perfectly qualified person, now gone. So she's feeling grief of separation. And she says, I know this is your illusory energy. Basically, she says, I know the philosophy. I know I'm not this body. And the body is only a covering of the real self. And the real relationship between myself and Kardama Muni is spirit soul to spirit soul. But the illusory energy's got a hold on me because family affection is very strong. So, you're God. And this is your illusory energy. You've covered me with your illusory energy. Could you please remove it? So I'm not suffering this undue grief and anxiety over separation from my husband and undue affinity for family life. So the circumstance is pretty extreme, but the circumstance can fit any one of us. Very appropriate. So that was chapter 25, beginning. This is chapter 31. And he's still answering the question. I mean, it's on topic. Everything that he says. Just a quick gloss. Chapter 25, the short answer is through association of devotees. You can go beyond, you can not just soothe, but go beyond altogether, go on the other side of that struggle with the material energy. Bhakti can carry you to the other side of the ocean of material affinity. Not just reduce it, not just be peaceful, but on the other side completely, it can't touch you. And that bhakti is made accessible through the bhakta. You need sadhu sangha. And then he describes who is a sadhu, how, what are the qualities of a sadhu, how to associate with a sadhu, what's the benefits of a sadhu. It's a wonderful introduction, 25. And then 26 is basically, it's Sankhya philosophy. It's a declaration of categories of matter and how the categories of matter cover spirit. And then the conclusion is, by fixing the mind on the Supreme Spirit in full devotion, one can go beyond that affinity for matter. He's still answering your question. And then the next chapters, we'll go very quickly. He describes in 27, very appropriate for devotees, particularly householders, he describes how to live a life of devotion in household life. It's Satyayuga, and the process in Satyayuga is meditation. So how does a meditator, householder live their life? So he describes, and including, you know, occupational duty and family and this and that. Very, very relevant discussion. It's on topic with the question at the beginning of chapter 25. He describes in detail the process of meditation and concludes that the goal of this process of meditation is bhakti. It's not dhyan yoga. Is may sound like where's the devotion there, but he makes it very clear. It's to bring one to and strengthen and further nourish devotion. And then the next two chapters, it's devotional service. Really wonderful description. And then the beginning of 29. Devahuti asks a very wonderful question. From what you've described, bhakti is pure. Is it possible for someone that's influenced by the modes of material nature just to engage in bhakti? And does bhakti become influenced by the modes of nature? Or does, when consciousness can be influenced by the modes of nature, bhakti isn't contaminated. So he says, yes. And so bhakti mixed with the mode of ignorance looks like this, with passion looks like this, with goodness looks like transcendence looks like this. Then he describes, it's really wonderful, the sadhana of transcending the modes of nature. Really nice. And then at the end of 29, the topic of time comes. He says, like a compare and contrast, time works in the spiritual world one way, and time works in the material world in a different way. And the mood of service is eternally with the soul. Service to the Supreme is eternally with the soul. But when there's undue affinity for matter, going back to 26 and, you know, the elements of material nature, one identifies with those things. And then time energy brings those things. The time energy in the living entity with desire mix with prakriti, and there's things that to get attached to. So then the message is to withdraw the attachment. He's still answering question of the beginning of 25. Withdraw attachment to the temporary and bring attachment to the transcendental. But if one doesn't, then the time energy captures one. Time energy brings things. Time energy maintains things. Time energy destroys things. And then one is bereft, filled with lamentation, remorse, because you lose things. It's just like our question at the beginning of 25. And then chapter 30 is, here's what the life of forgetfulness of that Supreme, that connection with the Supreme, looks like. And it's scary. It's not just like, you know, a scare tactic. It's the reality. And then, you know, there's degrees of darkness. There's the dharmic attachment. People engage in religious activities for fruitive intention. People that don't engage in religious activities with fruitive intention. And there's different binding forces. And he's like, invariably, even a dharmic person is going to make some mistakes, and so there's consequences for those mistakes. And then, you know, what to speak of adharmic based people, and you know, what their feelings are like, the feelings of attachment during this life, and because of that attachment, they compromise religious principle from time to time or regularly and do sinful things to maintain their family and their objects of attachment and so on. And then the body fails. It's kind of the opposite of what material society tries to do today. You know, perfume it and put a ribbon and a bow on the thing, make it look nice. Well, there's no attempt to make it nice. It's scary. The path of forgetfulness of one's relationship with the Supreme, thus fruitive activities, and what that looks like, the anatomy of adverse fruitive activities. That ends chapter 30. So I'm going to read the first four verses of 31. It's nice to get, when you study, to understand the context of what you're studying, because it's a dialogue, and it's meant to bring Devahuti to the position that she's asked. But that's a very nice... when Devahuti asks her question, the first response from Kapila Deva is he's silent, he just smiles. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes in his commentary, Kapila Deva is thinking, Devahuti, why are you speaking like this? you're my mother. And I'm your son. I'm the personality of Godhead, and you know it. So you're not bewildered and unduly attached to family life. You're just speaking this way for the benefit of others so others can hear and understand what to do about that circumstance in their life. So then he said, he obliges. You're very compassionate. I'll speak. So, chapter 31, Lord Kapila's instructions on the movements of the living entities. Text 1. The personality of Godhead said, under the supervision of the Supreme Lord, and according to the result of his work, the living entity, the soul, is made to enter into the womb of a woman through the particle of male semen to assume a particular type of body. So remember, he's left, gone to the hellish planets. After that hellish planet experience, some birth in one of the species of life, usually the lower species of life, somewhere in this planetary region, not necessarily on Earth. So he's paid his visit to the heaven, to hellish planets, and now he's, the soul is taking birth. Purport. As stated in the last chapter, after suffering different kinds of hellish conditions, a man comes again to the human form of body. And now that may take multiple births in lower species till one again comes to the human form by gradual evolution of consciousness through species of life. The same topic is continued in this chapter in order to give a particular type of human form to a person who has already suffered hellish life. The soul is transferred to the semen of a man who is just suitable to become his father. During sexual intercourse, the soul is transferred through the semen of the father into the mother's womb in order to produce a particular type of body. This process is applicable to all embodied living entities, but is especially mentioned for the man who was transferred to the Antatamishra hell. After suffering there, when he, who has many types of hellish bodies, like those of dogs and hogs, is to come again to the human form, he is given the chance to take his birth in the same type of body from which he degraded himself to hell. Like a big detour. And your GPS gave you the wrong signal. Went to hell. It took a long time to get back. Paragraph. Everything is done by the supervision of the Supreme Personality. Godhead, material nature supplies the body, but it does so under the direction of the Supersoul. It is said in Bhagavad Gita that a living entity is wandering in this material world on a chariot made of material, made by material nature. The Supreme Lord, as Supersoul, is always present with the individual soul. He directs material nature to supply a particular type of body to the individual soul according to the result of his work. And the material nature supplies it. Here, one word. Reta Kanashraya is very significant because it indicates that it is not the semen of the man that creates life within the womb of a woman, semicolon, rather the living entity, the soul, takes shelter in a particular particle of semen and is then pushed into the womb of a woman. Then the body develops. There's no possibility of creating a living entity without the presence of the soul, simply by sexual intercourse. The materialistic theory that there is no soul and that a child is born simply by material combination of the sperm and ovum is not very feasible. It is unacceptable. And that's, you know, the divine and demoniac chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Exactly, you know, what is not is what the demoniac persons think life is, but the consequence of sexual intercourse. That's what life is. It's a combination of particles of matter, and that's life. So you can do it in a test tube or whatever, and it's just, you know, mix chemicals and make life. And Prabhupada was very fond of repeating over and over again that when Srupa Damodara Maharaj was, as a professor, attended a, you know, a chemical evolution talk at in the question and answer time, he said, if I gave you the chemicals, can you produce life? He said he can't. So what's the use of all of his talk? That's how it happens. Okay, here's the chemicals. Can you do it? No. But so the Bhagavatam is very clear, and Prabhupada is emphasizing the point. It's not just chemicals or material elements combining with other material elements making life. It requires the presence of the spark of life. Then material nature providing the body for the spark of life. So as with earlier in the third canto and in Brahma Samhita, you know, the original act of procreation is described, that is to say, the glance of Mahavishnu carried by Shambhu. Shambhu is the halo of the glance of Mahavishnu. The original impregnation into the womb of material nature. Just, and it's that the replication of that is through the reproductive process here. It requires the male and the female, and it requires the soul taking shelter, just as in the original act of procreation, all the living entities are within, in a susupti state, within the body of Mahavishnu. So that means there's no creation, there's no bodies, there's just this pradhan, this cloud of the material energy that's undifferentiated over there. And he glances at pradhan in a compassionate mood, thinking, she wants some service. So let me give her some service. He has lots of service now. By that act of procreation, mothers have lots of service. And it's the glance, it's a detail, but the glance impregnates, not Mahavishnu impregnates, right, directly. Therefore, Shambhu is the progenitor. But he does so under the direction of Lord Vishnu. So, in that sense, remotely, he's the remote cause, or the cause of all causes. And then there's the sequence of causation following that. Cause and effect, and cause and effect, and cause and effect. Okay, text 2. On the first night, the sperm and ovum mix. On the fifth night, the mixture ferments into a bubble. On the tenth night, it develops into a form like a plum. Karkandhu, like a plum. Peshi, a lump of flesh. And after that, it gradually turns into a lump of flesh, or an egg, as the case may be, depending upon the species. Purport. The body of the soul develops in four different ways according to its different sources. One kind of body, that of the trees and plants, sprouts from the earth. The second kind of body grows from perspiration, as with flies, germs, and bugs, which is very interesting. The third kind of body develops from eggs, and the fourth develops from an embryo. That was one sentence. This verse indicates that after emulsification of the ovum and sperm, the body gradually develops either into a lump of flesh or into an egg, as the case may be. In the case of birds, it develops into an egg. In the case of animals and human beings, it develops into a lump of flesh. Text 3. In the course of a month, a head is formed. And at the end of 2 months, the hands, feet, and other limbs take shape. By the end of 3 months, the nails, fingers, toes, body, hair, bones, and skin appear, as do the organs of generation and the other apertures in the body, namely the eyes, nostrils, ears, mouth, and anus. Text 4. Within 4 months from the date of conception, the 7 essential ingredients of the body, namely chyle, C-H-Y-L-E. What's chyle? Anybody know? Chyle, blood, flesh, fat, bone, marrow, and semen come into existence. At the end of 5 months, hunger and thirst make themselves felt. At the end of 6 months, the fetus, enclosed by the amnion, begin to move on the right side of the abdomen. Report. When the body of the child is completely formed, at the end of 6 months, the child, if he is male, begins to move to the right side, and if female, she tries to move to the left side. And goes on. I wonder if a pediatrician would to look at this and would say, yeah, that's exactly what happens. Do you have any idea?
The first part's definitely correct. Very interesting when they talk about the shape like a plum.
Yeah.
The spinal cord forming.
And they don't, the month by month, you don't know?
I don't really know.
Okay. So. I know somebody who's a pediatrician. I know a few people are pediatricians. I'll ask to check it. Well, I could easily launch into, you know, one of Prabhupada's favorite topics is life comes from life. And when Prabhupada would have these discussions with others, it wasn't on the basis of, you know, Kapila Dev says so, or the Bhagavatam says so, or our authoritative scriptures say so. I mean, they do say so. Bhagavad Gita says so, and right here, very clearly, Bhagavatam says so. But largely, he would speak from common sense. Where is there the experience that life comes from that? And if you have the disposition, there is no such thing as spirit. Everything can be explained in terms of matter and the laws governing matter, and that's it. So here we go. Here's matter, the laws governing matter, that's it. And there isn't anything else. Then it, you know, it may look like, well, that's been compelling. One of the things that Prabhupada did when people would speak like that is, you know, you have your authority and you make your assertion and now you ask me to disprove it. Like, prove to me that there's God. Well, you know, who are you? I say, this is the way it is, you prove it wrong. As you're doing with me, I'll do it with you. This is the way it is, prove me wrong. Which is essentially what the Bhaktivedanta Institute did with Professor Henry Stapp, or Staff or something, I don't know how he pronounces his last name. I happened to be in Bombay when he was there. He is a Nobel laureate from Berkeley, some, I don't know if it was University of Berkeley or whatever, something, university there. And they invited him, a sabbatical, you know, a little paid vacation, to go to Bombay, and he stayed for 1 month. They gave him a little private suite and in the guest house. And the assignment was to read Sankhya philosophy of Kapila and see if it's falsifiable. And falsifiability is a scientific term, or at least, you know, scientists throw it around. Is there anything out there in the field of empiric science known, you know, somewhere out there that would take a statement, you know, the scientists use this themselves, so here's a statement of Kapila. Is there something out there that says this can't be because there's this empiric evidence? And the gentleman was more austere than most devotees, from what I observed. He was up before the devotees were up. And he didn't come and attend Mangalarti, but he was watching from the balcony of his room. And, you know, you look up, and there he was. And, you know, all day long, he's, you know, a very intense fellow, and all day long studying Sankhya philosophy. And at the end, you know, there's no evidence within the field of empiric science that he's aware of that says it can't be so because. Which is the challenge that, going back again, that material scientists thinking that they have, or assuming the position, posturing themselves that they have the authority, and prove me wrong. So I was on a morning walk with Prabhupada, and he was, at least appeared to me, he was teasing that mentality by saying, I have a theory. Remember very clearly, we were walking back to the Krishna Balaram temple, and he put his cane down. My theory is the moon has cool flames. Prove me wrong. I didn't take it that he meant that's what he was. He was just, I took it that way. He was just teasing the position, the posturing that scientists take. So there's light. And generally, light is, it has certain properties, and one of those properties, it gives heat. But the moon is very special. It has flames that are cool. Prove me wrong. And it went on and embellishing, you know, the notion. Prove me wrong. How can there be, so the position of the Bhagavatam is there isn't life without the spark of life. Just like this fermentation thing. In other words, the mother is there, and if that's the material nature, and if there's a suitable condition for a living entity to take birth, then a living entity is supplied. Karmana daivane trena, Prabhupada would quote, by the higher authorities, by the demigods, an arrangement is made. Here is the suitable place for the soul. And a soul takes birth by fermentation. You know, unlike the other ones, the other species, that the male and female gender, and that the soul is transferred by impregnation in birds, in human and animals, and with plants and trees. So some facility for that. is life possible without the touch of spirit? That's in your, what's life? Is it simply matter? So the reproduction process is a very important thing to consider. From whence does life arise? So the Vedic model is very clear. There's the supreme, super soul, overseeing material nature, and he oversees, you know, he oversees the karma of the living entity. You know, there's agents on his behalf, but the living entity goes into this particular body, and this particular species, and this particular mother, and this particular father, to suit their karma and guna. And the super soul oversees material nature, and material nature makes the arrangements for the body to be provided. And, you know, going back to chapter 29, he uses the time energy. It's his energy. In fact, there's this lengthy description about, on the one hand, time energy, and on the other hand, him. Because it's him. It's his potency. Directly. Not remotely or indirectly. It's his potency. So time energy then agitates matter. It's one of the ways in which the Supreme Lord controls matter remotely. Time energy moves matter. Just like it's spring. I really like spring. You know, all these trees that look really scrawny and weary from the winter, all of a sudden they produce flowers. Really, besides it's beautiful and spectacular, what a neat arrangement. Besides, you know, besides colorful. And how does a tree know to produce flowers? It's time energy. It just moves matter. So whatever one might say, you know, the RNA, DNA, blah, blah, how did that information get stored and what triggers it to go to the next one? The time energy moves matter. It's subtle. Who's seen an atom? Or who's seen an electron? Who's seen time? Well, we see the effects of electrons and we see the effect of time. We know about it because of its effect. There may be another system, just like the Ayurvedic system is to analyze the health and well-being of a body based on the three doshas. And that's a nice system. There may be another system that also explains in some reasonable way. And you can say, based upon this and that and the other finding or circumstance, then there's such and such. That's not to say that you can't have another system to analyze things. But the time energy is real. And the time energy moves matter. And then sustains it, and then withdraws it. And you know, it's the Vedic picture of time as it moves in cycles. Like, you know, like a life moves in cycles, or a day of Brahma moves in cycles, or one of the cycle of four yugas moves in cycles, and there's big cycles. There's an earlier chapter in this third canto, the calculation of time by the atom. It's really the smallest unit of time, according to this Bhagavatam, is the time it takes for the sun to cross one atom. And when an atom is the smallest divisible particle of matter, the sun is moving, and the sun to cross one atom, that's whatever the term is in Sanskrit. And so many of those make another, and then so many of those make another, and so many of those. It just keeps multiplying mathematically to two parardas. That's, you know, the life of Brahma. And you're getting closer to eternal time, and then there's eternal time. And then you collapse it down and down and down and down and down. So time moves in different ways, according to Lord Vishnu, because it's his time energy. It's really fascinating. I don't understand it all, but it's fascinating for sure. In fact, time is eternal. In the process of creation, according to the Bhagavatam, when Rama Devi, the internal potency of Mahavishnu, because of her closeness to Mahavishnu, she understands his desire. He wants the living entities within the two things, compassion and compassion. He wants living entities that are within his body in this susupti state to experience the fullness of happiness, all the potential of happiness. He wants that. And he wants, simultaneously, pradhan, this material energy, the shadow of Rama Devi, to have some service. And so Rama Devi, knowing the will, the desire of her Lord, she takes one of her subpotencies, eternal time, and transfers that eternal time to the glance of Mahavishnu, that then comes in this past, present, future feature of time. It's a shadow of eternal time, or it's a reflection of eternal time. And then that's the time of, you know, creation, and then the time of annihilation. And then further there's breakdown and breakdown and sub, smaller, smaller, smaller. Features of time. And time acts differently upon different living entities according to the consciousness of those living entities. It's really a neat system. And then he withdraws. That's how creation begins. And if you want to end creation, it's really simple. He just withdraws time. It all collapses. It goes back into its latent state. Living entities come back into his body, and all the material elements collide and go back into the subtle, and back into pradhan. And it's like that for the duration of creation, then another cycle. And meanwhile, he is engaged in his eternal pastimes with Rama Devi. This is like, you know, a secondary thing. I've never found the detail of what are the pastimes of Mahavishnu with Rama Devi. Just repeatedly says he's engaged in his eternal lila with her, eternal pastimes within. The story is fascinating, but you know, how does it work? Well, if you want to be a creator, there's a nice way to make it work. It makes a lot of sense. And then, is it falsifiable? I'd be interested to hear from a pediatrician. These first, you know, this section, does it match? Is it falsifiable? I want to find out. I don't know. Anyway, let's see. I might say it a little differently, but I doubt if it's falsifiable. No, not like that. It can't be like that. Empirically, it can't be like that because... There was an article, I'll just end with this, there was an article in Back to Godhead magazine many years ago that Sataputta and Ravindra Sarup Prabhu, I heard them speaking about this topic before the article was written. There was a period of time in European history when European scholars started taking interest in the Vedas. And there were other European scholars that were Christian-based, and they didn't like that. They didn't want scholars to take an interest in the Vedas. And so there was one particular person whose name I can't remember that was very, you know, fired up and wrote a message that said, there are two empiric things, that are spoken of in the Vedas, one has to do with anthropology, another has to do with cosmology. And as science progresses, evidence from science in terms of the dating of things, because there's numbers, empiric information regarding the dating of things, and there's empiric information in the Vedas regarding cosmology. So as science develops, it's going to debunk all of the Vedas, and then the whole thing can be trashed, including all these fantastic stories about lineages of kings and all that other, mythology. So around that time, there were schools purposefully given the name Indology, like just kind of euphemistically sounding like mythology. Oh, you say mythology, it's Indology. And then there was another fellow that took the writings of this scholar, and he traveled all over Europe saying boo on the Vedas because of these two things. And so devotee scholars have been very active in addressing those two things. It's what inspired Sariputta did with Dhritakarma's assistance, did a decade of research on anthropology, and it ended up in Forbidden Archaeology. But the text was, this is my understanding, was Sariputta's work by name, but really the one that did all the writing and legwork and research and so forth was Dhritakarma, so it ended up being, Dhritakarma was the named author. And then further and further writings, Human Devolution instead of Human Evolution, and then the work that Sariputta did in Vedic cosmology. It was specifically to address that European history where empiric evidence in these two areas that were challenges from the Christian intellectuals of Western Europe against the Vedas. And it still stands. It's still current. I know one devotee, he is now a tenured professor at Rutgers University, initiated devotee, but he's Professor Dr. Bryant, Edwin Bryant from Italy, who his PhD thesis at Columbia University in Sanskrit had to do with the Aryan invasion. It had to do with this dating thing. And because Max Müller and some of his colleagues during his time had this whole notion that had to do with the text, the Brahmana text of the four Vedas indicates something different than, what is commonly accepted, where the origin of life is, blah, blah, of civilized life. His whole PhD thesis was on that. First, he did what he told me. His master's thesis was so brilliant. He said, do your PhD thesis on this. This is really good. Because it was a direct confrontation of the Western perspective of the Aryan invasion theory. The details of it I couldn't comprehend. It was too subtle and detailed. But a number of devotees in a kind of coordinated way have done their different PhDs specifically to challenge people out here in Cornland, Illinois don't know of these things, but intellectuals shape how people think because intellectuals have shaped a lot of thought of people in general, like mechanistic science and how people view life and the deterioration of theism. It has a huge impact on the quality of life, these topics. It's not just, for Hare Krishna people to feel happy that, we have some scriptural authority that says something or other. The atheistic challenge, as Kali Yuga progresses, is it's more and more rampant. And with that more and more rampant, it's just advancement of Kali Yuga. It's necessary to advance Kali Yuga, to have further and further atheism and, you know, systematic atheism. I'll end with this. I just read, didn't read the entire article, but it was I think Harvard University economics professor wrote an article, very, very insightful article, that said America was successful, democracy in America was successful because of theism. That's how America was founded. People came from Europe for religious freedom, and they're very religious people. And over a period of time, that religiousness diminished. And because people became more interested in prosperity than religious, you know, purpose, like in God we trust, kind of, now it's got to be taken away out of the courtrooms and on currency, and, you know, there are all these challenges of atheism because separation of church and state, etc., etc. And he said, that's what has made democracy successful. And when that goes, the whole system is going to collapse. And he gives his economic reasons why it's going to collapse. It's like very interesting. But it's the deterioration, it's the advancement of Kali, the deterioration of God consciousness. So I think it's important that, you know, in universities in particular, where the intellectual faculty is honed a little bit, to try to understand what these messages are and the significance of these messages as they impact the quality of life. Not just that we have a kind of intuitive faith, but more that, you know, a scriptural basis for that intuitive faith. So if someone says, you know, mythology or rubbish, or what's wrong with you? Don't you know that all there is matter and the laws governing matter? What happened to you? What's wrong with you? Just a little while ago, I was at a home program somewhere, and the parents that were the host very impolitely embarrassed the heck out of their teenage son by, you know, saying that during the questions and answers, can you address this question that our son has? He, in his debate club, you know, he's basically a theist. We believe in God, he believes in God. But in his debate club, there are these other people that aren't, that challenge, you know, why do you believe in God? What's wrong with you? Everybody knows, you know, chemical evolution and Big Bang, and why do you have these convictions? And he doesn't have the answer. He still wants to come to the temple, and he loves devotional things, but, you know, he has this peer pressure with his friends. How do I answer that? Or how does he answer that? And, you know, as devotees, we should be able to arm this young man. Because the onslaught of atheism is strong. So our own members and our own family, we not like, you know, put weapons in their hands and have them go do battle or something, but at least their own conviction should be well protected and be with a big smile, be able to say such and such with conviction. Not just, you know, I believe and that's good enough for me. Or the quality of life of devotion is so much better. I like the quality of devotion better than the quality of what you have. That's, you know, that's a practical answer, but what's the basis for that? Anyway, we have this wonderful opportunity through the Bhaktivedanta purports and Srimad Bhagavatam, and exhaustive presentation of wonderful understandings of Purusheya Shabda coming from perfected sources, it behooves us to go deeply into the subject matter and help educate our, at least our own members and families and so forth, what to speak of others. Okay, I'll end. See if there's any discussion. Yes.
Maharaj, in the beginning you mentioned that Kardamuni went back to forest like after Lord Kapila was big enough.
Yeah.
So why did he feel the need to go to the forest to complete his austerities when Vishnu was at his home?
It's an obvious question. And the only answer I have to that, I've been down that road a number of times, is he was setting an example. Great personalities do that. Now, he certainly could have stayed, because why is he going to go meditate on Vishnu when Vishnu is his son? It's right there. But setting an example. Great souls do that.
One more question. You mentioned like the soul in the human form of like very simple activities, like he goes to the Gadish planet.
Mm.
So the degree of that simpleness, like, does it depend, like if someone is Arya and he has like,
yes,
he has the scripture, so he will be having like more
fun. Exactly. Yes. And there's so many other, here's another. It's elaborately discussed in the previous chapter. If a man, in order to maintain his family, does something sinful, he implicates his family. They're less responsible, less culpable, but they're culpable. But he's like, you know, a murderer, the accomplice to the murder. If someone steals and they're put in jail, the family is disgraced, or murders or something. So they suffer, but certainly less than the person that does the bad thing. So there's degrees for sure, and one who knows better and does is more culpable than one that doesn't know. There's culpability even you don't know. Take it further. There's a degree that is, let's say a child does something to a sadhu. There's no blame there. There's no culpability. But there's a samskar. And so it needs to be addressed by the parents. Not that because there's a karmic reaction that's coming to the child for something, but they need to explain somehow so that samskar gets addressed. Because otherwise it can easily repeat itself. Just because the impression is there. Go ahead. Something else?
Yeah, something. It's regarding the perspiration you told that.
Regarding the which?
Perspiration.
Parsification.
Perspiration.
Perspiration.
Yeah. So doesn't defy that like life comes from life? Like, because perspiration does it have?
There's a soul that enters into that medium. That's my understanding of how, from perspiration or fermentation, those two. There's a suitable place for a soul to take shelter. And by higher authority, it's arranged. The soul takes shelter, becomes a germ or a fly or something. I was always curious about that, you know, fruit flies. There's some fruit and it's fermenting, and they'll pet all of these flies. Where'd they come from? It's one of the four categories. I don't understand it because, you know, where's the father? There's the mother. Where's the father? And the only thing I can understand so far is, I mean, I've not read anything, but it's gaiva. An arrangement is made. And the soul takes shelter there. Now there's a body. A germ or whatever. Yes.
So, regarding to the fact that there are people who are atheists that we come into contact, and they often share the dark beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I have not read the scriptures very extensively or anything, but even if I do, so am I, would I be qualified enough to counter those arguments? I mean, just because...
Sure. I mean, you don't have to... Two things. You don't have to, like, arm wrestle with them. And then, gotcha. That's not the requirement. That's not, you know, that shows that you're qualified to have this discussion with them. That's one thing. So it's not, you know, you've got a weapon and they got a weapon and you fight and you win. Rather... Second is that, you know, qualified is according to what you do understand. You in a perhaps simple way, you state what you do understand. Even, you know, a very simple way to do that is like Sri Damodar Maharaj did with his professor. You say life comes from matter. If I give you the chemicals, can you produce life? Have you ever seen that the thing is life coming from chemicals? Now you say when there's procreation, that's all it is. And I say, that's not all that it is. So I'll give you the chemicals. You go to your laboratory or do whatever you want to do and produce life. You won't. I challenge you. You won't. Or is it possible? We're working on it. The post-data check thing. And then there's others that are logical, you know, the complexity of life and so forth and so on. There's in European history, there's not proof of God, there's not disproof of God, so it's a stalemate. You can't disprove. You do that program of prove me wrong, or the other one saying prove me wrong, and it's a stalemate. So the purpose of your having a dialogue with them is not to prove them wrong. Or, you know, then, oh, you're right, I accept. They're not going to accept. But you show that, you know, not just you have a spine, but you have a brain. And, you know, there's compelling indication. And, you know, be prepared. You know, at least, you know, the conclusion is please consider. There is another way of looking at this idea. Here's the other way. Please consider. Or prove it wrong. Please consider. My understanding of one of the approaches that Sariputta used, I admire Sariputta enormously. One of his approaches was on these two areas. Doesn't prove the Vedic model is right of cosmology, but it explains the model explains things empirically, precisely. So now, where did that wisdom come from? It came from persons that had no technology. They didn't have Hubble telescopes mounted on spacecraft that took pictures and sent the signals back, and then the scientists analyzed them, and now they know the distance between this planet and that planet and the size of the planet. They didn't have that technology, but they had the numbers. How did they get that? Descending knowledge. Here's just one for example, Vedic cosmology is geocentric, Earth-centered. From the point of observation, the cosmology is described. Copernicus came along and said, no. Sun-centered. Heliocentric. And the distance between Earth and the Sun is such and such. It just happened to be off by a factor of a few hundred. Then, as telescopes got better and better, it got closer and closer and closer and closer to the Vedic number. Now it's, you know, almost the same. Almost the same. Because technology has improved the guesswork of Copernicus. So now, again, how did it get that number right? Although the paradigm is geocentric. Just different equations, you put in the numbers and calculate them, and you get it, you get the answer of where the planets are in relation to, you know, it's in such and such date and such location, time and place. Because they needed it. Cosmology was necessary for calculating things. Auspicious times for planting your crops, and when will there be a this and that, you know, solar, you know, the celestial events, cosmology events. They knew. How did they know that? On what basis? So that's not, doesn't prove anything. It's just compelling. And then you add other compelling. And then take that and take it over here to, you know, where does everything come from? It's a primordial, since the beginning of time, Lord Brahma asked it. And everybody, you know, the scientists ask it, the thoughtful people ask it, where does everything come from? So our picture is everything comes from the Supreme Person. And the basis for that is, the basis for that conviction comes with all these other things. Not proof. The proof is the realization, the disclosure. Krishna discloses, I am this. But that's disclosed, in fact, to the person who has bhakti. And otherwise, people can read Krishna saying, everything comes from me, and they go, no. Rubbish. Everything comes from a big bang. I learned in eighth grade science, everything comes from a big bang. So you're qualified. You know, based on, you know, whatever, as you progress in Krishna consciousness and you continue to read the scripture, your understanding, the realization that you'll gain from what's being said will grow. Just naturally. You know, as your consciousness becomes more elevated and thus less covered, when you read, other light will come in. Then you'll be able to explain more clearly to others, but you know, at the present stage, whatever. And the purpose is not take a stick and hit them. The purpose is to have them consider another model, a God-centered model. It's nice. It's a nice service. Something else? Okay. See the Prabhupada key?
Yeah. Okay.